7.1 After he returned from Florida, he packed up his things and moved 4 blocks south to an apartment on West 107th Street between Broadway and Amsterdam Avenue. 2 rooms plus kitchen for the extravagant yet wholly affordable sum of $130 a month. There were benefits to having money in the bank. But even though he preferred living without roommates and was glad to have left behind the haunted interiors of West 111th Street, a necessary act, sleeping alone was difficult. The top pillow was either too firm or too soft. The bottom pillow was either too flat or too lumpy. And every night the sheets scratched his arms or twisted themselves around his legs. And with no Amy beside him anymore to lull him into drowsiness with the placid motions of her breathing, his muscles couldn't relax, his lungs refused to slow down, and he couldn't stop his mind from running at a speed that churned out 52 thoughts per minute, one for every card in the deck. How many cigarettes smoked at 2:30 in the morning? How many glasses of red wine drunk past midnight to quell the jitters and induce his eyes to shut? Neck aches nearly every morning. Stomach cramps in the afternoon. Shortness of breath in the evening. And morning, noon, and night, a heart that beat too fast. It wasn't about Amy anymore. He had spent the summer reconciling himself to the fact of their separation, to the inevitability of their splitting apart for good, and he no longer blamed her or even blamed himself. They had been moving in opposite directions for close to a year, and sooner or later the filament that had been holding them together was bound to snap. Snap it did, and so big and so powerful was the snap that it had shot her clear across the country. California. The calamity of distant California. And since the beginning of May, not a single word from her or about her. A zero as large as a hole in the sky. At his strongest moments, he could tell himself that it was all for the best. That the person Amy had become was no longer a person he could live with or want to live with. And therefore he should regret nothing. At his weakest moments, he missed her. Missed her in the same way he had missed his 2 severed fingers after the crash. And now that she was gone, it often felt as if another part of his body had been stolen from him. When he stood in the middle ground, between strongest and weakest, he prayed that someone would come along to occupy the other half of his bed and cure him of his insomnia. New digs, the dream of a new love, the long summer of work on his translations that persisted through the fall, winter, and spring, the somatic troubles caused by the loss of his old love and or his current state of mind that eventually landed him in the emergency room at St. Luke's Hospital with 27 daggers in his gut. Not the burst appendix he had thought it was, but an attack of gastritis. The ongoing mayhem in Vietnam, coupled with numerous other shocks that occurred throughout the latter half of 1968 and the first half of 1969. They were all part of Ferguson's story. But for now, attention must be drawn to the war he was fighting against the symbolic figure of Nobodaddy, the character invented by William Blake, who stood in Ferguson's mind as the representative of the irrational men who had been put in charge of running the world. By mid-September, when he went back to Columbia for his last year of college, he was feeling disillusioned and bitter about most things. Among them, the things he had discovered concerning the manipulations of the American press. And now he was reconsidering whether he wanted to join the ranks of that fraternity after he left college. Whether the decision he had made back in high school to become a professional journalist was still worth making in light of the corruption and dishonesty he had witnessed firsthand during the days of the Columbia revolt last spring. The New York Times had lied. The so-called paper of record, the supposed bastion of ethical, unbiased reporting, had faked its story about the police intervention on April 30th and had published an account of the events that was written before those events ever took place. A.M. Rosenthal, the deputy managing editor of the Times, had been tipped off by someone in the Columbia administration about the impending bust several hours before the TPF showed up in the neighborhood. And with the knowledge that 1,000 troops would be called in, the lead story on the front page of the early morning edition on April 30th announced that those 1,000 men had cleared the occupied buildings of the demonstrating students and had arrested 700 of them on charges of criminal trespass, a number that had been plugged in at the last minute after the article had been written. But not one word about what had really happened, not one word about the bloodshed and violence, not one word about the battered students and professors, and not one word about how the police had used handcuffs and nightsticks to pound one of the Times' own reporters in Avery Hall. In the next morning's paper, the front page lead again failed to mention the police riot that had taken place on campus during the bust. Although there was a modest story about alleged acts of police brutality hidden on page 35, Lindsay Auder's report on police. The third paragraph of the article contended that, quote, "Police brutality in such a situation is hard to define, as the remarks of dozens of Columbia students suggest. To an experienced anti-war or civil rights demonstrator, yesterday morning's police action on the Columbia campus was, for the most part, relatively gentle," unquote. The sadistic beating of Times reporter Robert McGee Thomas Jr. was not mentioned until the 11th paragraph. Dozens of students. But which students, Ferguson wanted to know, and what were their names? And who were the experienced veterans of the anti-war and civil rights movements who had been roughed up by the police at earlier demonstrations? No undergraduate working for the Columbia Daily Spectator would have been allowed to publish such a piece, not without providing direct quotations along with the identities of the students who had made those comments, if indeed any of them had been made. Was this a news story, Ferguson asked himself, or an editorial posing as a news story? And what, pray tell, was the definition of the word gentle? Another front-page article on May 1st was written by Rosenthal himself, a curiously disjointed, rambling mélange of sorrows, impressions, and angry disbelief. It was 4:30 in the morning, the first paragraph began, and the president of the university leaned against the wall of the room. This had been his office. He passed a hand over his face. "My God," he said, "how could human beings do a thing like this?" He wandered about the room. It was almost empty of furniture. The desks and chairs had been smashed, broken, and shoved into adjoining rooms by the occupying students. On page 36 of that same morning's edition of the Times, another article told of the damage done to various rooms and offices by the occupiers of Mathematics Hall. Shattered windows, an overturned cabinet of library index cards, dismembered desks and chairs, cigarette burns on carpets, tipped over filing cabinets, broken doors. Quote, "A secretary, returning to the building for the first time since it was seized last Thursday night, looked about disgustedly. They're just pigs," she said. The pigs, however, were not the students who had occupied the buildings, but the police who had gone into the buildings after the bust. They were the ones who had smashed the desks and chairs, the ones who had tossed streams of dripping black ink against the walls, who had ripped open 5- and 10-pound bags of rice and sugar and scattered their contents around offices and classrooms, and had dumped broken jars of tomato paste onto floors, desks, and filing cabinets. The ones who had punched out windows with their clubs and nightsticks. If their aim was to discredit the students, the strategy worked, for within hours of that second police rampage, scores of photographs attesting to the damage were circulated around the country. The ink-splattered wall was especially popular, and the young rebels were turned into an uncivilized pack of hooligans and thugs, a gang of barbarians whose sole purpose was to destroy the most sacred institutions of American life. Ferguson knew the real story because he had been one of the Spectator reporters assigned to investigate the charges of vandalism against the occupying students, and what he and his fellow reporters had discovered, through sworn affidavits from members of the faculty, was that no ink had been on the walls when a contingent of professors toured the empty math building at 7 o'clock on the morning of April 30th. After they left, only police and press photographers had been allowed to enter the building. And when the professors returned later in the day, they found the walls covered with ink. Ditto for the desks, chairs, filing cabinets, windows, and packages of food. In good condition at 7 a.m., pillaged and destroyed by noon. It didn't help that the publisher of the New York Times, Arthur Oakes Sulzberger, was a member of the Columbia Board of Trustees, nor that William S. Paley, head of the CBS television network, and Frank Hogan, the Manhattan District Attorney, sat on the board as well. Unlike many of his friends, Ferguson was not in the habit of looking for conspiracies to account for the shrouded operations of Nobodaddy's henchmen. But how not to wonder that America's most influential paper had willfully distorted its coverage of the events at Columbia, and that the most influential television network had invited Columbia President Grayson Kirk to appear on Face the Nation, but never asked one of the student leaders to give the other side of the story. As for the question of law enforcement, Ferguson and his fellow students on Morningside Heights were all aware of what the police had done both during and after the bust, but no one else seemed terribly interested. Case closed. Ferguson walked back onto the Columbia campus that September, feeling crushed and demoralized. A state of depletion and spent resolve as the August outrages continued to echo inside him. Soviet tanks crossing into Czechoslovakia to exterminate the Prague Spring. Daley calling Ribbikov a motherfucking dirty Jew at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, as 23,000 local, state, and federal cops gassed and pummeled young demonstrators and journalists in Grant Park, the mob crying out in unison, "The whole world is watching." And then Ferguson began his senior year with New York in yet another crisis, the deranged spectacle of public school teachers going out on strike to contest community control of the school board in Ocean Hill, Brownsville. Yet one more clash between blacks and whites, race hatred in its ugliest, most suicidal form, blacks against Jews, Jews against blacks, more poison to fill the air as the world turned its eyes to the Olympics that were about to begin in Mexico City, where police battled a horde of 30,000 protesting students and workers, killing 23 of them and arresting thousands. And then, in early November, the 21-year-old Ferguson voted for the first time, and America elected Richard Nixon as its new president. All during the first 6 months of that last school year, he felt as if he had been trapped inside a stranger's body and could no longer recognize himself when he looked at his face in the mirror, which was also true of the thoughts he was thinking whenever he looked inside his head, since they were mostly the thoughts of a stranger as well. Cynical thoughts, splenetic thoughts, disgusted thoughts that had nothing to do with the person he had once been. Eventually, a man would come down from the north and help cure him of his bitterness, but that didn't happen until the first day of spring, and the fall and winter were hard on Ferguson, so hard that his body broke down and he wound up in the emergency room. If he wasn't going to be a journalist anymore, then it made no sense to go on reporting for The Spectator. For the first time in years, he would be able to crawl out of his glass monastery and rub shoulders with the world again, not as a chronicler of other people's actions, but as the hero of his own life, however troubled and confused that life might have been. No more reporting, but nothing so drastic as a total break, since he loved the people he worked with there. If he respected any journalist in America now, it was Friedman and the other Spectator boys. So rather than cut all ties to the paper, he relinquished his spot as an associate member of the board and turned himself into an occasional reviewer of books and films, which meant that he handed in about one longish piece every month. Speculations on such divergent topics as the posthumous poems of Christopher Smart and Godard's newest film, Weekend, which Ferguson argued was the first instance on record of what he called public surrealism, as opposed to the private surrealism of Breton and his followers. For the 2.5 days from Friday afternoon to Sunday night, commonly referred to as the weekend, made up approximately one-third of the week in industrial and post-industrial societies such as France and America, just as the 7 or 8 hours an individual spent in bed every night constituted about one-third of that person's life. The dream time of private men and women, in parallel to the dream time of the society they lived in, and Godard's anarchic, blood-splattered film of smashed-up cars and cannibalistic sex was nothing if not the exploration of a mass nightmare, which was just the sort of thing that spoke most deeply to Ferguson now. Hilton Obensinger and Dan Quinn were appointed the new editors-in-chief of the Columbia Review. David Zimmer and Jim Freeman were the new associate editors, and Ferguson became one of nine on the literary board. 2 issues per year, as in the past, but now money had been raised to set up something called the Columbia Review Press, which would allow them to publish 4 small books in addition to the 2 issues. When the 13 gathered for their inaugural meeting at Ferris Booth Hall in mid-September, there was little argument about the first 3 titles on the list. Poems by Zimmer, poems by Quinn, and a collection of stories by Billy Best, an ex-Columbia student who had dropped out 5 years earlier but was still in touch with various members of the review. The 4th book posed a problem. Jim and Hilton both begged off, saying they didn't have enough strong work to fill 64 pages, perhaps not even 48 pages, and then, during a pause in the discussion, Hilton unwrapped a 1-pound package of ground beef, bunched it up in his hands, rose from his chair, and flung it with great force against the wall, shouting the word meat as it smacked against the surface and stuck there for a few seconds before it slid down to the floor. Such was Hilton's brave Dada spirit, and such was the spirit of that year, when the best minds on campus understood that the most important questions could be answered only by off-the-wall non-sequiturs, in contrast to the up-against-the-wall tactics of the previous spring. And once everyone had applauded Hilton for his lesson on the finer points of logic, Jim Freeman looked at Ferguson and said, "What about your translations, Archie? Do you have enough of them to make a book?" "Not quite," Ferguson said, "but I did a lot of work over the summer. Can we wait until the spring?" By unanimous vote, it was decided that a small anthology of Ferguson's 20th century French poets would be the 4th and final book published that year. When Ferguson reminded them that it was illegal to publish translations without buying the rights to the originals, no one seemed to care. Quinn pointed out that the edition would be limited to 500 copies, most of which would be given away for free. And if a French publisher happened to come to New York and stumble across Ferguson's book on a shelf in the Gotham Bookmart, what could he do about it? They would all be gone by then, scattered far and wide across the country, and no doubt across other countries as well. And why would anyone bother to go after them for a couple of $100s? "I'm with Dan," Zimmer said. "Fuck money." For the first time in what must have been weeks, if not months, Ferguson laughed. Then they voted again, just to make it official, and one by one, all 13 members of the Columbia Review Board repeated Zimmer's words, "Fuck money." Jim and Hilton set a cutoff date of April 1st for handing in the finished manuscript, which would give them enough time to print the book before they all graduated in June. And as the months pushed on, Ferguson often wondered what would have happened to him if Jim Freeman hadn't asked his question. For with each month that passed, it was becoming more and more clear to him that the deadline was saving his life. Those poems were his refuge, the 1 small island of sanity where he didn't feel estranged from himself or at odds with everything that was. And even though he had finished many more translations than he had let on at the meeting, no fewer than 100 pages so far, perhaps 120, he forged on with his versions of Apollinaire, Desnos, Sandrars, Edouard, Reverdy, Zara, and the others, wanting to accumulate an abundance of material to work with when the time came to pare down the selection to the 50 or 60 pages the press could afford to publish, a dissonant book that would dart around from the broken-hearted cries of the pretty redhead to the mad, musical tumbling act of Zara's Approximate Man, from the discursive rhythms of Sandrars' Easter in New York to the lyrical grace of Paul Éluard. "Do we reach the sea with clocks in our pockets and the noise of the sea in the sea, or are we the carriers of a purer and more silent water? The water rubbing against our hands sharpens knives. The warriors have found their weapons in the waves, and the sound of their blows is like the rocks that smash the boats at night. It is the storm and the thunder. Why not the silence of the flood? For we have dreamt within us space for the greatest silence, and we breathe like the wind over terrible seas, like the wind that creeps slowly over every horizon." So Ferguson had his extracurricular jobs of translating and reviewing, each of them alternately and often simultaneously both a struggle and a pleasure for him. The pleasure of the struggle to get it right. The frustrations of not getting it right more often than he should have. The poems that defeated him and could not be rendered into acceptable English after 2 dozen stabs at them. The failure of his piece on the effect of listening to different kinds of music as sung by different kinds of female voices, Janet Baker, Billie Holiday, Aretha Franklin, because in the end it was impossible to write about music, he decided, at least impossible for him. But still he managed to produce some articles that were less than awful enough to hand in and publish, and still the pile of translations continued to grow. And in the midst of all that, there were the classes he was taking as well, mostly seminars in English and French literature at that point, because he had fulfilled all his academic requirements except one, science, the abominable 2-year science requirement that was an utter waste of time and effort, in his opinion. But he discovered there was a course designed for lunkheads like himself, Introduction to Astronomy, which apparently no one failed because the professor was against flunking non-science students in science. And even if you never showed up for any of the classes, all you had to do was take a multiple-choice exam at the end of the year, a test you could not fail even if you failed to beat the guesswork odds and scored only 10%. So Ferguson registered for that lunkhead course in celestial mathematics, but because he was living in a stranger's body and didn't know who he was anymore, and because he felt nothing but contempt for the rulers of Columbia and the pointless subjects they were forcing him to study against his will, he went into the college bookstore at the beginning of the first semester and stole the astronomy textbook. He, who had never stolen anything in his life, who had worked at Bookworld during the summer after his freshman year and had caught 6 or 7 students in the act of stealing books and had thrown them out of the store. Now he was a book thief himself, slipping a 10-pound hardcover under his jacket and calmly walking toward the exit and out into the sunshine of Indian summer. Now he was doing things he never would have done in the past, behaving as if he were no longer himself. But then again, perhaps this was the person he had become now, for the truth was that he didn't feel guilty about pinching the book. He didn't feel anything about it at all. Too many nights at the West End, too many nights getting plastered with Zimmer and fog, but Ferguson craved the company and the talk. And on the nights when he went into the bar alone, there was always the off chance of running into a girl who was just as lonely as he was. Off chance rather than chance, because he was so dreadfully inexperienced when it came to such matters, having spent close to 5 years of his youth and early adulthood with one girl, the eternally departed Amy Schneiderman, who had loved him and then not loved him and had tossed him aside. And now he was starting from the bottom again, a beginner in the art of amorous conquest, knowing next to nothing about how to approach someone and start a conversation. But a tipsy Ferguson was more charming than a sober Ferguson. And 3 times during his first 3 months back at Columbia, when he had tippled enough to overcome his shyness, but was not too far gone to have lost control of his thoughts, he wound up in bed with a woman, once for an hour, once for several hours, once for the whole night. All of the women were older than he was, and on 2 of those 3 occasions, he was the one who was approached, rather than the other way around. The first occasion was a disaster. He had enrolled in a graduate seminar on the French novel, the only undergraduate in a class with 2 graduate student men and 6 graduate student women. And when one of those women turned up at the West End in the 3rd week of September, he walked over to her and said hello. Alice Dotson was 24 or 25. Not unattractive or unwilling, but plump and awkward, perhaps not accustomed to the protocols of casual sex, perhaps even more shy than he was. And when he found himself in her arms later that night, her body looked and felt so different from Amy's that he was thrown by the unfamiliarity of it all. And then, to compound his confusion, she was far more passive in bed than the ardent and spirited Amy had been. And as Ferguson went about the job of trying to copulate with her, his mind kept wandering from the task at hand, and even though Alice seemed to be enjoying herself in a mild, dreamy sort of way, he couldn't finish what he had started. which was something that had never happened in all his years with Amy, and the pleasant tumble he had been looking forward to was turned into a wretched hour of impotence and shame. Nor was he ever allowed to forget that blow to his masculine pride, since the class met for 2 hours every Monday and Thursday, and twice a week for the rest of the year, there was Alice Dotson sitting around the table with the other students, doing her best to ignore him. The second occasion left no scars but taught him a valuable lesson. A 31-year-old secretary of pleasing but unremarkable aspect came into the West End one night with the express purpose of picking up a student. She called herself Zoe, last name never given, and when she fixed her eyes on the solitary Ferguson, she sat down next to him at the bar, ordered a Manhattan, and began talking about the World Series currently in progress between the Cardinals and the Tigers. She was pulling for St. Louis because she had been raised in Joplin, Missouri. After 3 or 4 sips of her drink, she tested the waters by placing her hand on Ferguson's thigh, and because he was susceptible to provocations of that sort, he responded by kissing her on the back of the neck. Zoe downed the rest of her Manhattan. Ferguson polished off his beer, and then they climbed into a taxi and headed for her place on West 84th Street, exchanging no more than 6 or 7 words as they pawed and kissed each other in the back. It was all rather impersonal, he supposed, but her lithe body moved in ways that excited Ferguson, and after they reached her apartment, the sorry organ that had let him down so cruelly with Alice Dotson had no trouble finishing what it had started with Zoe No Name. It was his first one-night stand, or almost a night, in that there was a first round followed by a second round, but after the second round ended at 2 o'clock, Zoe asked Ferguson to leave, assuring him they would both feel better about it in the morning if they didn't spend the rest of the night together. He didn't know what to think. Fun while it had lasted, he said to himself, but sex without feeling had its decided limitations. And as he walked back to his apartment in the windy autumn night, he realized that it hadn't been worth it. The third occasion was memorable, the one good thing that happened to him during those long, empty months. Although the West End was essentially a student hangout, there were a number of regulars who had stopped being students or had never been students, the oddball dreamers and drunks who sat alone in booths plotting the overthrow of imaginary governments or were having one last round before they took another crack at AA or reminisced about the old days when Dylan Thomas used to sit at the bar reciting his poems. Among those regulars was a young woman Ferguson had met all the way back at the beginning of his freshman year, a slender, long-legged beauty from Lubbock, Texas, named Nora Kovacs, someone he had always felt attracted to, but had never even flirted with because of Amy. A most unusual girl who had come up north to attend Barnard in 1961, had dropped out in the middle of her first semester, and had remained in the neighborhood ever since. Foul-mouthed, raunchy, go-fuck-yourself Nora, who had drifted into the profession of removing her clothes in front of strangers, a striptease artist who toured far-flung outposts of American industry to enhance the lives of the womenless men who worked in oil fields, shipyards, and mills, a well-paid performer who had vanished from New York for a couple of months to bounce around Alaska or the Gulf Coast of Texas, but she would always come back to claim her seat at the bar of the West End, where she went nearly every night to chat with anyone who happened to be sitting next to her, talking about her adventures on the road and sounding off about the dim-witted nobodaddies who were destroying the universe. Ferguson didn't know her well, but over the years they had had 5 or 6 long conversations together, and because Ferguson had once helped her out on a matter of considerable importance, there was a special bond between them, even if they weren't close friends. It went back to a night during his freshman year when he had gone into the West End without Amy and had spent 4 hours talking one-on-one with Nora in a side booth. She was about to go off on her first stripping tour, she had told him, and she needed to come up with a stage name for herself, since she sure as hell wasn't going to hawk her wares as Nora Luann Kovacs. In a sudden flash of inspiration, Ferguson had said, "Star Bolt." "Hot damn," Nora had said back to him. "Hot diggity damn, Archie. You're a genius." And perhaps for that one moment, he had been a genius. For Star Bolt was a name that radiated glamour, freedom, and sexual power, the essential qualities every stripper needed to rise to the top. And whenever he had run into Nora over the ensuing years, she had always thanked him for turning her into what she playfully called the Queen of the Hinterlands. Ferguson liked Nora because he was attracted to her, or he was attracted to her because he liked her. But he also understood that Nora was a mess, that she drank too much and took too many drugs, that she had evolved in what the guardians of virtue would have called a trollop or a slut, a young woman traveling down a fast road to rack and ruin, too outspoken for her own good, too comfortable in the gorgeous body God had given her for no other purpose than to test the morale of weak men and wavering sinners. A woman who fucked whomever she pleased and openly talked about her cunt, her clit, and the pleasures of having a hard cock rammed up her ass. But, at the same time, Ferguson found her to be one of the more intelligent members of the West End crowd, a girl with a warm heart and kind impulses. And even though he suspected she wouldn't live past 30 or 35, he felt nothing but affection for her. He hadn't seen her in months, perhaps not for half a year, but there she was one night in early November, just a couple of days after Nixon had defeated Humphrey, which had further darkened the already dark mood that had enveloped Ferguson that fall. And when he sat down next to her at the bar, Nora laughed one of her big laughs and planted a kiss on his left cheek. They talked for about an hour, covering a number of vital subjects such as the arrest of Nora's ex-boyfriend for selling drugs, Amy's definitive exit from Ferguson's life, the disappointing announcement, for Ferguson, that Nora would be leaving for Arizona the next morning, and the curious fact that while Nora had been jiggling her boobs in Nome, a phrase he vowed never to forget, she had managed to keep abreast, Nora's joke, of what had been going on at Columbia last spring by reading issues of The Spectator, which had been sent to her every day from New York by her friends Molly and Jack. As a consequence, she had read all of Ferguson's articles about the occupation of the buildings, the police bust, the strike, and everything else. The news might have been slow in getting to Alaska, but his articles were damned good, she said to him. Fucking terrific, Archie. And after he thanked her for the compliment, he told her that he had retired from reporting. Perhaps permanently, he said, perhaps temporarily, he wasn't sure yet. But one thing he was sure of was that he didn't know what to think anymore. That his brain had been bled dry and that shit, thank you, Sal Martino, was everywhere. Nora said she had never seen him looking so low. I'm lower than low, Ferguson answered. I've just reached the 93rd sub-basement, and the elevator is still going down. There's only one solution, Nora said. A solution? Out with it, please, at once. A bath.
A bath?
A nice warm bath. With the two of us in it together. Never had a proposal been so graciously offered to him, and never had Ferguson been so pleased to accept. 25 minutes later, as Nora turned on the faucets of the tub in her apartment on Claremont Avenue, Ferguson told her that God had indeed given her a glorious body. But more important than that, he had also given her a sense of humor. And even though she would be leaving for Arizona in the morning, Ferguson wished he could marry her now, and even though he knew he couldn't marry her now or at any time in the future, he wanted to spend every minute of the next 11 hours with her, to be with her every second until she walked onto the plane. And now that she was being so nice to him, he wanted her to know that he loved her for it and would go on loving her for the rest of his life, even if he never saw her again. "Come on, Archie," Nora said. "Kick your clothes into the corner and climb in. The bath is full, and we don't want the water to get cold, do we?" November, December, January, February. He was still in college, but already finished with college, limping his way to the end as he pondered what to do with himself after they handed him his degree. First of all, there would be the matter of letting Nobodaddy peer into his anus and examine his testicles, of coughing the obligatory cough, and taking a written test that would prove whether he was intelligent enough to die for his country. The draft board would be summoning him for his army physical sometime in June or July, but he wasn't worried about that because of his two absent fingers. And now that the pro-war Quaker, with a secret plan to end the war, was sitting on his throne and talking about troop reductions, Ferguson doubted the military would be desperate enough to start filling its regiments with one-thumbed soldiers. No, the problem wasn't the army. The problem was what to do after the army rejected him. And among the dozens of things he had already decided against was graduate school. He had considered it for 3 or 4 minutes over Christmas break with his parents in Florida. But just saying the words out loud had made him understand how deeply the thought of spending one more day of his life in a university revolted him. And now that February was about to turn into March, the deadline for sending off applications had passed. Teaching school was another option. A push was being made to enlist recent college graduates to teach in poor neighborhoods around the city, the black and Latino slums of upper and lower Manhattan, the tumble-down wards of the outer boroughs. And at least there would be something honorable about doing that for a couple of years, he told himself, trying to educate the kids from those disintegrating barrios, and in the process no doubt learning as much from them as they would ever learn from him. Mr. White Boy doing a small bit to make things better rather than worse. But then he would come back to Earth and think about his inabilities to talk in front of people when more than 5 or 6 strangers were in the room, the paralyzing self-consciousness that made it a torture for him to stand up and speak in public. And how could he manage a classroom of 30 or 35 10-year-olds if no words ever came out of his mouth? He wouldn't be capable of doing it. Even if he wanted to do it, it wouldn't be possible for him. He had already dismissed journalism, but sometime around the 2nd or 3rd week of February, he began to wonder if he hadn't been too hasty. For even if the big-time establishment press was no longer worth thinking about, there were other branches of journalism to consider. The anti-establishment press, otherwise known as the alternative press or the underground press, had been growing stronger in the past year or so. And with the East Village Other, Liberation News Service, and the Rat all in bloom, not to mention several dozen independent weeklies in cities outside New York, rags so wild and unconventional that they made the Village Voice look as stodgy as the old Herald Tribune. Perhaps there was something to be said for working at one of those places. At least they were against all the things Ferguson was against, and for many of the things he was for. But there were a number of drawbacks to be examined as well, including the problem of low pay. He wanted to support himself with his work and not have to dig too deeply into his grandmother's fund, and the greater problem of writing exclusively for people on the left. His hope had always been to change people's thinking, not just confirm what they already thought, which would hardly put him in the Panglossian position of living in the best of all possible worlds. But in a world where best and possible seldom appear together in the same sentence, a possible job he could live with and not feel tainted by was surely better than no job at all. A.I. Ferguson, ace reporter of the Weekly Blast, the American Bible of malcontents and vitiated Faustians, the paper of record for the chosen few. If nothing else, it was a subject that demanded some careful thought. So Ferguson went on thinking for the next 15 or 20 days, and then came the Night of the Daggers, which fell just past midnight on March 10, 1969, 1 week after his 22nd birthday and 4 days after he had gone to Jim Freeman's apartment on West 108th Street and handed him the finished manuscript of The Pretty Redhead and Other Poems from France, a too large selection he had told Jim to cut down in any way he saw fit. And as Ferguson paced the rooms of his own apartment on the night of the 10th, composing a long, introspective letter to Nora Kovacs in his head, he felt a sharp twinge in the lower part of his abdomen, one of many that had plagued him in recent months. But rather than subside after 10 or 12 seconds, as most twinges did, this one was followed by a second, more powerful twinge, which hurt so much that it no longer qualified as a twinge, but as genuine pain. And a moment after that second stab, the assault had begun. The daggers in his gut, the 27 spears that left him writhing on the bed for close to 2 hours. And the longer the pain went on, the more likely it seemed that his appendix or some other organ was rupturing inside his body, which so frightened him that he willed himself to stand up, put on his coat, and stagger off to the emergency room at St. Luke's Hospital, 7.5 blocks away. Ferguson clutching his stomach and grunting loudly as he wobbled forward in the night, stopping every so often to cling to a lamppost when he felt in danger of falling to the ground. But for all that, no one on Amsterdam Avenue seemed to notice he was there. No one bothered to come up to him and ask if he needed help. Not one person among the 8 million in New York was the least bit interested in whether he lived or died. And then he waited for an hour and a half until he was called into a room, where a young doctor spent 15 minutes asking him questions and probing his belly, after which Ferguson was told to go back to the waiting room, where he went on sitting for another 2 hours. And when it became clear that his appendix was not going to explode that night, the doctor saw him again and prescribed pills, telling him to stay away from spicy foods, to avoid whiskey and other hard drinks, to shun grapefruits, to stick to the blandest diet possible for the next 2 or 3 weeks, and if another attack should occur during that time, he would do well to have another person accompany him to the hospital. And as Ferguson nodded at the doctor's sound and helpful instructions, he asked himself, but what person? And who in the world would be there for him the next time he thought he was going to die? He stayed in bed for 4 days, drinking weak tea and nibbling on crackers and slices of dry toast. And 7 days after he was well enough to go out again, a man named Carl McManus came down from upstate New York to talk to the departing members of the Spectator staff. The editorial board of Friedman, Branch, Mulhouse, and the others had already finished its March-to-March 1-year term and had handed the paper over to the new board. And Ferguson, the occasional freelance critic, had already written the last article he would ever publish in The Spectator, a somber, admiring review of George Oppen's latest collection of poems, of Being Numerous, which had come out on March 7th, 3 days before the Night of the Daggers. The irony was that he was the only one of the seniors who was still toying with the idea of going into journalism. The overworked, mind-blasted Friedman was planning to hibernate in one of the public school teaching jobs that had scared off Ferguson. Branch was going to med school at Harvard. Mulhouse was staying at Columbia to do graduate work in history, but they all came to the meeting because McManus had written a letter to Friedman back in the spring praising the work of the Spectator staff during the Troubles, and praise from Carl McManus meant something to them. The executive editor of the Rochester Times Union had been editor-in-chief of the Spectator in 1934, and in the 30-plus years since then, he had gone to Spain to cover the Spanish Civil War, had gone to Asia to cover the Pacific Front in World War II, and had stayed at home to cover the Red Scare in the late 40s and the Civil Rights Movement in the 50s and early 60s. A long stint of editorial work with the Washington Post after that, and now, as of a year and a half ago, the head man at the Times Union, where he had found his first job after graduating from Columbia in the 30s. Not quite a legend. He had never published a book and rarely appeared on radio or TV, but a known personage, a man with a large enough reputation to have lifted the spirits of the exhausted Spectator crew when his letter arrived in early May. A Brooklyn accent, a broad Irish face with protruding ears, a body that could have belonged to an ex-linebacker or longshoreman, alert blue eyes, and a mop of graying reddish hair, long enough to suggest an interest in keeping pace with the times, or else the hair of a man who had forgotten to go to the barber shop for his next haircut. Informal, more at ease with himself than most men, and a good, resonant laugh when Mulhouse proposed they all go down to the Lion's Den on the first floor, the student snack bar that served, in Mulhouse's riff on the familiar New York phrase, the worst cup of coffee in the world. 7 people sitting around a brown Formica table, 6 students in their early 20s and the 56-year-old man from Rochester, who got straight to the point and told them he'd come back to Columbia in search of recruits. Several positions were about to open up at his paper, and he wanted to fill them with what he called fresh blood, hungry kids who would bust their asses for him and turn a decent operation into a good one, a better one. And because he was already familiar with their work, and knew what they were capable of, he was willing to hire 3 of them on the spot. That is, he added, if anyone was crazy enough to want to move to Rochester, New York, where the winds that gusted off Lake Ontario in winter could freeze the snot in your nose and turn your legs into popsicle sticks. Mike Aronson asked him why he was talking to them and not to anyone from the School of Journalism, or was he planning to stop in there too? Because, McManus said, the experience gained from 4 years of work at The Spectator is more valuable than 1 year in a graduate program. The story you covered last spring was a big, complicated business, one of the biggest college stories in years, and every one of you sitting at this table did a good job, in some cases a remarkable job. You've been through the fire, you've all been tested, and I know what I'll be getting if any of you chooses to join up. Then Branch raised the far more important issue of the New York Times. What did McManus think of their reporting about Columbia last spring, and why would any of them ever want to work for the mainstream press when all they did was print lies? They broke the rules, McManus said, and I'm just as angry about it as you are, Mr. Branch. What they did bordered on the monstrous, the unforgivable. Much later, when Ferguson had a chance to reflect on what happened that afternoon, to think about why he did what he did, and to ask himself what the consequences of not doing it would have been or not have been, he understood that everything turned on the word monstrous. A lesser, more prudent man would have said irresponsible or shoddy or disappointing, none of which would have had the smallest effect on Ferguson. Only monstrous carried the full force of the indignation he had been walking around with for the past months, an indignation that was apparently shared by McManus, and if the two of them felt the same way about that one thing, then they must have felt the same way about other things as well. And if Ferguson still had any interest in working for a daily paper, or in finding out whether journalism was the solution for him or not, then perhaps it wouldn't be such a bad idea to brave the winds of the frozen north and accept the offer from McManus. It was only a job, after all. If it didn't work out, he could always move on and try his hand at something else. "Count me in," Ferguson said. "I think I'm willing to give it a shot." There were no other takers. One by one, Ferguson's friends all bowed out. One by one, they all shook McManus's hand and said goodbye. And then it was just the two of them, Ferguson and his future boss. And because McManus's plane wasn't scheduled to leave until 7 o'clock, Ferguson decided to cut his class on English romantic poetry and suggested they walk across the street to the West End, where they could continue the conversation in more pleasant surroundings. They found a spot in one of the front booths, ordered 2 bottles of Guinness, and after some brief words about Columbia then and Columbia now, McManus started to fill him in on the geography of the place where he would be going, talking with a refreshing bluntness about the dying world of northwestern New York, the only part of the country where the population was going down, he said, nowhere more drastically than in Buffalo, which had lost nearly 100,000 people in the past decade. Once glorious Buffalo, as he put it, not without a touch of mock blarney in his voice, the jewel of the old canal and shipping culture, now a half-empty wasteland of ruined and abandoned factories, derelict houses, boarded-up, caved-in structures, a bombed-out city never touched by bombs or war. And then, moving beyond dismal Buffalo, he took Ferguson on a short tour of some of the other cities in the region, choosing his epithets carefully as he touched on sad-sack Syracuse, anemic Elmira, ugly Utica, hapless Binghamton, and ragged Rome, which had never been the capital of any empire. "You make it sound so enticing," Ferguson said, "but what about Rochester?" "Rochester was a bit different," McManus said, "a better brand of decline, a place that was falling more slowly than the others, and therefore still more or less solid, at least for now. A city of 300,000 in a metropolitan area of about 1.2 million, which accounted for the Times Union's circulation of 250,000 copies per day. A minor league town, of course, but not a two-bit minor league town, with the AAA Red Wings feeding the Baltimore Orioles a high-protein diet of Boog Powells, Jim Palmers, and Paul Blairs, home of Eastman Kodak, Bausch & Lomb, Xerox, and the indispensable French's mustard, companion to every American hot dog since 1904. Which made it a city where most people had jobs and businesses that weren't about to head down south or go abroad. On the other hand, in spite of the sailboats and country clubs, the splendid film archive and decent Philharmonic orchestra, the good university and even better music school, which was one of the best in the world, there were the gambling, prostitution, and extortion rackets controlled by Frank Valenti and the mob, as well as vast zones of poverty and crime, the rough black slums that housed 15 to 20% of the population, many of those people struggling or out of work or doing drugs. And in case Ferguson had forgotten, Ferguson hadn't forgotten, there had been the 3 days of rioting in the summer of 1964, 1 week after the riots in Harlem, 3 dead, 200 stores looted and damaged, 1,000 arrests, and then Rockefeller had called in the National Guard to put an end to it, the first time on record that the Guard had breached the walls of a northern city. At that point, Ferguson mentioned Newark, Newark in the summer of 1967, and how it had felt to stand with his mother on Springfield Avenue during the night of the broken glass. "So you know what I'm talking about," McManus said. "I'm afraid so," Ferguson replied. "Chilly springs," McManus continued, "lovely summers, tolerable autumns, brutal winters. You'll see George Eastman's name everywhere you turn, but remember that Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony lived in Rochester, too. And even Emma Goldman put in time there, organizing sweatshop workers at the end of the last century. Also, and this is very important, whenever you're in a down mood and feel you might want to kill yourself, go for a walk in Mount Hope. It's one of the biggest and oldest public cemeteries anywhere in America, and still the most beautiful spot in the city. I often go there myself, especially when I have an urge to think deep thoughts and smoke long, fat cigars. It never fails to clarify and sometimes even illuminate the resting ground of 300,000 departed souls." 300,000 people above ground in Rochester, Ferguson said, and 300,000 below. What our good friend might have called fearful symmetry. Or the marriage of heaven and hell. So began the first conversation between Ferguson and Carl McManus, the warm-up to the 2 hours they spent together at the West End discussing the kinds of stories he would be writing for the paper, the initiation period of local reportage that would eventually lead to state and national events if he panned out, which McManus thankfully seemed to accept as a foregone conclusion, the salary he would be given to start with, low but not to the point of dire struggle or heart-wrenching misery, detailed information about the staff and the running of the paper, and the more they talked, the more pleased Ferguson became with the decision he had made, his instinctive "count me in" as an answer to the word "monstrous." And now that he was getting to know McManus a little bit, he understood he would learn much by working for this man, that unlikely Rochester was in fact a good and plausible move, and as he held up his left hand and showed it to McManus, who was the first stranger who had ever asked him how he had lost his fingers, he said, "I'm hoping this keeps the draft board off my back so I can take the job." "Don't worry about the draft board," McManus said. "You've already signed up with me, and no man can serve in two armies at the same time." Little by little, his heartbeat slowed down that spring, and the daggers withdrew from his belly. He bought himself a new pair of down pillows, continued to avoid grapefruits, and took 3 more baths with Nora. He corrected the proofs of his book. He ordered a 3-month subscription to the Times Union and began following day-to-day life in Rochester. Asked to join the newly formed, whimsically named Columbia Poem Team, he traveled to Sarah Lawrence and Yale with Obenzinger, Quinn, Freeman, and Zimmer to give joint readings to the students. Speaking in public was impossible, but reading from his typed-up translations was not. High-energy events followed by considerable drinking and laughter and, at Sarah Lawrence, a 90-minute conversation with a stunning co-ed named Delia Burns, whom he desperately wanted to kiss but didn't. He wrote the final papers for his literature seminars and managed not to oversleep on the morning of the astronomy exam. There were 100 questions with 5 possible answers for each, and since Ferguson had attended only 1 lecture and had never opened the textbook, he circled the A's through E's at random and was heartened to score 18%, which was good enough to earn a passing grade of D+. Then, to round off a small act of almost invisible rebellion, He returned to the college bookstore and sold the book back to them, thus sticking it to them twice. They gave him $6.50 for it. 10 minutes later, as he walked down Broadway toward his apartment on West 107th Street, a panhandler approached him and asked for a dime. Rather than give a dime, Ferguson thrust the whole $6.50 into the man's open palm and said, "Here you are, sir, a gift from the trustees of Columbia University, with my compliments." His book was published on May 12th in a fine, soft-covered edition of 72 pages that gave him much pleasure to look at and hold in his hands in the hours after it was lifted out of a cardboard box in the review office. And within 1 week, he had given away all but 5 of his 20 author's copies to friends and relatives. The cover was illustrated with a reproduction of the well-known photograph of Apollinaire from the First World War, the one that showed the head of Wilhelm Apollinaris de Kostrovitsky, wrapped in bandages, following the operation to repair the shrapnel wound to his temple. The poet as martyr. The modern age, born in the mud of the trenches. France in 1916. America in 1969. Both trapped in never-ending wars that devoured their young. 3 copies were consigned to the Gotham Book Mart, another 3 to the 8th Street Bookshop, and 6 to the paperback den on campus. Inestimable Zimmer, Ferguson's closest, most admired friend among the people in his class, reviewed the book for The Spectator and said nothing but kind things about it. Excessively kind things. Quote, "The works in this assemblage of poems from France should not be looked on as mere translations, but as English poems in their own right, a valuable contribution to our own literature. Mr. Ferguson has the ear and the heart of a true poet, and I, for one, will be going back to these magnificent works again and again as the years roll on." Excessively kind. But such a person was young David Zimmer, who would soon be facing the big question all of them would be facing the instant they left Morningside Heights. In Zimmer's case, the dilemma expressed itself in a rhyme. Yale or jail? A 4-year fellowship to do graduate work in literature at Yale, or 2 to 5 years of jail if they wound up drafting him into the army? Yale or jail? What a neat little ditty that was, and what a world Nobodaddy had wrought. It wasn't going to be hard to say goodbye to Columbia, which was living through another round of protests and demonstrations in the spring of 1969, events that Ferguson was willing himself to ignore for reasons of pure self-preservation. But he would miss his friends and some of his professors. He would miss not being able to further the education he'd received from Nora on the handful of nights they had spent together. And he would miss the hopeful boy who had come there in the fall of 1965. The boy who had slowly vanished over the past 4 years and would never be found again. On the same morning in mid-June that Ferguson coughed the cough and took the written exam at the draft board building on Whitehall Street, Bobby George and Margaret O'Mara were joined in holy wedlock at St. Thomas Aquinas Church in Dallas, Texas, where Bobby was the starting catcher for Baltimore's AA ball club, which happened to be the same day, according to a letter Ferguson received from his Aunt Mildred, that the still silent and permanently decamped Amy attended the SDS National Convention in Chicago, a rancorous meeting that devolved into an angry clash over tactics and ideology between the PL faction and the group that would come to be known as the Weathermen, which led to the crack-up and sudden, shocking demise of SDS as a political organization. Uncle Henry and Aunt Mildred had kept in sporadic contact with Amy during her first year of law school, and Mildred wrote to her former one and only to tell him that Amy had decided, quote, to turn her back on the delusions of revolutionary activism and devote herself to the more realistic cause of women's rights. The moment of revelation occurred when a man named Chaka Wells, the deputy minister of information for the Chicago Black Panthers, stood up to attack the PL and, for no discernible reason, started talking about the women in SDS by using the term pussy power and saying that, quote, Superman was a punk because he never even tried to fuck Lois Lane, a sentiment echoed a few minutes later by another Black Panther, Jewel Cook, who declared that he was for pussy power as well, and that, quote, the brother was only trying to say to you sisters that you have a strategic position in the revolution. Prone. It was a tired old joke by then, one that Amy had heard dozens of times in the past years. But that day in Chicago, she finally had had enough, and instead of joining forces with the Weathermen, the break-off faction that included ex-Columbia students Mike Loeb, Ted Gold, Mark Rudd, and others, all of whom had been expelled from Columbia at the end of the spring term last year, she stood up from her seat and walked out of the convention center. As Aunt Mildred put it at the end of the letter, lapsing into the patronizing Aunt Mildred tone she often resorted to when talking about other people, quote, I thought you should know about this, Archie, even if the two of you are no longer a couple. It seems to me that our Amy is finally beginning to grow up. Bobby George says, I do. Ferguson sticks out his left hand and shows it to a U.S. Army doctor. Amy walks out of the Chicago Coliseum and quits the movement for good. Was it possible that all three of those things happened at the same instant? Ferguson would have liked to have thought so. Even more interesting, by the time Ferguson moved to Rochester at the beginning of July, Bobby had already been promoted to the AAA Red Wings of the International League. In a city where Ferguson knew absolutely no one, how improbable was it that his oldest friend should be there with him? Not for the long haul, perhaps, but at least until the end of the summer and the close of the baseball season, the early months of adjustment and settling in. Bobby and his bride, Margaret, two people he had known forever, pretty Maggie O'Mara, with her short, flowered dresses and drooping socks, sticking out her tongue at rough-and-tumble, mouth-breathing Bobby George in the kindergarten class with Mrs. Canobio in Montclair. Now the still-pretty but sophisticated and opinionated 22-year-old Margaret, with her degree in business management from Rutgers, and the ever-amiable powerhouse Bobby, climbing the ladder to the major leagues. An unlikely union, Ferguson felt, not anything he would have predicted. But the mere fact that Bobby had persuaded Margaret to marry him must have meant that after 2 years in the Army and a year and a half as a professional ballplayer, he was finally beginning to grow up as well. As for Amy, it was none of his business now, which meant he shouldn't have cared about what she was doing or not doing with herself. But Ferguson did care. He could never fully bring himself not to care. And as the months went on, he felt more and more relieved by her decision not to join the Weathermen in Chicago. Their old friends from Columbia had gone insane. The intractable power of the great oblivious one had thwarted their idealistic impulses and crushed their ability to think rationally anymore. And through a long series of wrong assumptions and wrong conclusions and wrong decisions based on those wrong assumptions and wrong conclusions, they had worked themselves into a corner where they were left with no choice but to believe that an army of 100 or 200 middle-class ex-students with no followers and no support anywhere in the country could lead a revolution that would bring down the American government. That government was destroying its young by shipping off the poorest and least educated ones to fight in the war that was supposedly ending but wasn't ending, while the privileged young were destroying themselves. 8.5 months after Amy walked out of the Chicago convention, her old friend from Columbia SDS, Ted Gold, along with his fellow weathermen, Diana Uten and Terry Robbins, were blown up and killed in a townhouse on West 11th Street in New York when one of them connected the wrong wire to a pipe bomb they were building in the basement. Uten's body was so thoroughly obliterated that the sole means of identifying her came from the print on a severed finger found in the rubble. There was nothing left of Robbins. His skin and bones had dematerialized in the fire caused by the detonation of the gas mains, and his death was confirmed only after the weathermen sent out word that he had been there with the two others. Ferguson drove up to Rochester in the old Impala on July 1st, but his job at the Times Union wouldn't be starting until August 4th. 5 weeks to acclimate himself to his new surroundings, to hunt for an apartment and transfer his money to a local bank, to hang out with Bobby and Margaret, to wait for his new classification from the draft board, to see Kennedy's promise fulfilled as he watched a pair of American astronauts walk on the surface of the moon, to carry on with the project he had started in New York of translating the poems of François Villon, and to get New York out of his system. The largest, least expensive apartment he could find was in a rundown neighborhood called South Wedge, a cluster of blocks on the west side of town, not far from the Genesee River. McManus's beloved Mount Hope was just a few steps away, as were the University of Rochester, and a large grassy terrain called Highland Park, where the annual Lilac Festival was held every spring. Prices were low in that part of the world, and for $87 a month, he took possession of the entire top floor of a three-story wooden house on Crawford Street. The house itself wasn't much to look at, with its cracked ceilings and rickety staircase, its overclogged storm gutters and yellow paint peeling on the facade, but Ferguson had three furnished rooms and a kitchen all to himself, and the light that poured through the windows in the afternoon was so much better for his mental health than the darkness of West 107th Street that he was willing to overlook the house's flaws. The owners lived in the apartment on the ground floor, and even though Mr. and Mrs. Crowley's weakness for vodka often led them to bicker at night, they were never less than cordial with Ferguson, which was also true of Mrs. Crowley's unmarried younger brother, Charlie Vincent, the World War II vet, who occupied the middle apartment and lived on monthly disability payments, an agreeable sort who seemed to do little else but smoke, cough, and watch television, along with suffering through an occasional bad night when he would call out in his sleep, shouting, "Stuart, Stuart," at the top of his voice, so loud and so panicked that Ferguson could hear him through the floorboards upstairs. But who could blame Charlie for reliving his past from time to time when his guard was down? And how not to pity the teenage boy who had been sent off to fight in the Pacific 26 years ago and had come home to Rochester with a head full of nightmares. As it turned out, Bobby and Margaret had to leave town before there was a chance to do much hanging out together. Ferguson had one dinner with them. He managed to see Bobby play in one game for the Red Wings, but the team was on the road when he arrived on July 1st, and 4 days after Bobby returned to Rochester on the 10th, the Orioles catcher broke his hand in a collision with a New York Yankee at home plate. After batting .327 in his first 3 weeks of AAA, Bobby was called up to join the roster of first-place Baltimore, and if he could hold his own against American League pitching, it was unlikely he would ever work in the minors again. Impossible not to feel happy for him, impossible not to exult in his promotion, and yet, hard as it was for Ferguson to admit to himself, impossible not to feel glad they were moving away. It had nothing to do with Bobby. Bobby was still the same old Bobby, an older, more experienced, more reflective Bobby, but still the big-hearted boy who was incapable of thinking a bad thought about anyone. Ferguson's most constant and loving friend, the one who loved him more than anyone else ever had, including Amy, especially including Amy, and how alive Bobby was on the night of their one dinner in Rochester at the Crescent Beach Hotel, hugging Margaret every 14 seconds and talking about the old days of Montclair, the glory days of their sophomore year when Ferguson's hand was still intact and they were on the team together, the youngest starters on that conference-winning 16-2 team, the team that had pulled off the play. Of course, Bobby had to talk about the play, because he never tired of talking about it. And when Ferguson asked him to tell the story again for Margaret's benefit, Bobby smiled, kissed his wife on the cheek, and launched into his account of that May afternoon 6 years ago. "This is how it was," he said. "We're down 1-0 to Bloomfield in the last inning. One man out and two men on, Archie at third and Caleb at second, Caleb Williams, Rhonda's older brother. And then Fortunato comes up, and Coach Martino signals for the bunt, two taps to the brim of his cap, and then he takes off the cap and scratches his head. That was the signal, the only time he ever gave it. Not just a bunt for a suicide squeeze to bring in one run, but a double suicide squeeze to bring in two. No one in history had ever thought of that play. But Sal Martino invented it because he was a baseball genius. A tough play to execute because you need to have a fast runner on second. But Caleb was extra fast, the fastest runner on the team. And so the pitch comes in and Fortunato lays down a good bunt, a slow little dribbler to the right of the mound. By the time the pitcher gets to it, Archie is already crossing the plate to tie the score. Figuring there's nothing else to do, the pitcher throws to first, and Fortunato is out by 3 or 4 steps. But what the pitcher doesn't realize is that Caleb started running at the same time Archie did, just as he was going into his windup, and by the time the first baseman catches the ball, Caleb is 3/4 of the way home. Everyone on Bloomfield is shouting to the first baseman, "Throw the ball, throw the ball." So he throws the ball home, but the throw is late, a hard throw right into the catcher's glove, but it's a couple of seconds too late, and Caleb slides in with the winning run. A cloud of dust, and Caleb is jumping to his feet with his arms in the air. Victory out of loss. A big win from a squiggly little nothing of a teeny tiny bunt. I've never seen anything like it. I've played in hundreds of games since then, but that was the best and most exciting thing I've ever seen on a baseball field. My number one all-time moment. 2 runs, boys and girls, and the ball didn't travel more than 30 feet. No, the problem wasn't Bobby, who was in the full flower of his inimitable Bobbiness by then. The problem was Margaret, the same Margaret who had developed a crush on Ferguson when she was 7 years old, who had written him an unsigned love letter when she was 12, who had made eyes at him throughout high school, and had actively rejoiced at Anne-Marie Dumartin's return to Belgium, who had been the one girl he had been tempted by during his 4.5 months apart from Amy in their senior year, who had been the one whose mouth his tongue would have entered if not for Bobby's infatuation with her, who had mocked him as Cyrano when he had tried to intercede on Bobby's behalf. The dull but intelligent and achingly attractive Margaret, who for reasons he could not fathom, was now the wife of his oldest friend. For Ferguson was fairly stunned by how little attention she paid to Bobby's monologue about the double suicide squeeze, by how she kept looking at him across the table and not at her husband while her husband spoke, eating him up with her eyes as if she were telling him, "Yes, I've been married to this kind, soft-headed lummox for a month now, but I'm still dreaming about you, Archie. And how could you possibly have rejected me for all those years, when in fact we were made for each other from the start? And here I am. Take me, and damn the consequences, because all along I've always wanted only you." Or so Ferguson gathered from the way she looked at him in the restaurant of the Crescent Beach Hotel, and the truth was that he was aroused by her, as a solitary, celibate, unloved bachelor, searching for love as a stranger in a new town. How could he not have been aroused by the looks she was giving him? And who knew if he wouldn't have capitulated to her that summer if she and Bobby hadn't left for Baltimore, since there would have been countless opportunities for them to see each other alone. All the nights when Bobby would have been on the road, playing games in far-off Louisville, Columbus, and Richmond, and how many times would he have accepted her invitation to come to dinner at her apartment? How many bottles of wine would they have drunk together? Surely his resistance would have weakened at some point. Yes, that was what her eyes were telling him as they sat across from each other at the hotel restaurant. "Give in. Please give in, Archie." And because Ferguson understood that he might not have been strong enough to keep his hands off her if she had stayed, he was more than happy to see her go. Last year, the concentric circles had fused into a solid black disc, an LP record with a single blues song playing on side A. Now the record had been turned over, and the song on the flip side was a dirge called "Lord, Thy Name is Death." The melody entered Ferguson's head just days after he started his job at the Times Union, and as the first bar floated in from California on August 9th with the words "Charles Manson" and "The Tate LaBianca Murders," it wasn't long before it modulated into the suicide on Halloween night of young Marshall Bloom, co-founder of Liberation News Service, which Ferguson had seriously considered joining straight out of college, which segued by the middle of fall into a verse about Lieutenant William Calley and the My Lai massacre in South Vietnam, and then, as the last year of the 1960s went into its final month, the Chicago police belted out a loud staccato refrain by shooting and killing Black Panther Fred Hampton as he lay asleep in his bed, and 2 days after that, as the Rolling Stones mounted the stage at Altamont to sing the rest of the song, a crew of Hell's Angels jumped a young black man waving a gun in the crowd and stabbed him to death. Woodstock 2, the flower children and the heavies, and behold how quickly the day hath melted into night. Bobby Seale, strapped to a chair with a gag in his mouth by order of Judge Julius Hoffman, as the original 8 were turned into the 7. The weathermen launching a kamikaze attack against 2,000 Chicago cops during the days of rage in October. Ferguson's old school pals girded in football helmets and goggles, jock straps and cups bulging on the outside of their pants, poised to do battle with chains, pipes, and clubs. 6 of them were shot, hundreds were carted off in paddy wagons. To what end? To bring the war home, they shouted. But since when had the war ever not been at home? 4 days after that, Vietnam Moratorium Day. Millions of Americans said yes, and for 24 hours nearly everything in America stopped. 1 month to the day after the day, 750,000 people marched on Washington to end the war, the largest political demonstration ever seen in the New World. Nixon watched a football game that afternoon and told the country it wouldn't make any difference. At the Weathermen gathering that December in Flint, Michigan, Bernadine Dorn extolled Charles Manson for having killed those pigs, meaning the pregnant Sharon Tate and the others who had died with her in the house. One of Ferguson's old pals from Columbia stood up and said, "We're against everything that's good and decent in honky America. We will burn and loot and destroy. We are the incubation of your mother's nightmare." Then they went into hiding and never appeared in public again. And there was Ferguson, back in his role as the smallest dot at the center of the smallest circle, no longer surrounded by Columbia in New York, but by the Times Union in Rochester. As far as he could tell, it had been a fairly even trade, and now that he was in the clear, his 4F notice arrived 3 days before he started work. The job was his as long as he could prove he deserved it. There were 2 dailies in Rochester. Both of them were owned by the Gannett Publishing Company, but each one had a different purpose, a different editorial doctrine, and a different outlook on life. In spite of its name, the Morning Democrat and Chronicle was solidly Republican and pro-business, whereas the Afternoon Times Union was more in the liberal camp, especially now that McManus was in charge. Liberal was better than conservative, of course, even if it was finally just another term for middle of the road, which is hardly where Ferguson stood on any political issue of the moment. But for the time being, he was content to be where he was, writing stories for McManus and not for the East Village Other, the RAT, or LNS, which had gone through such a violent split that it had broken into 2 separate organizations, the hardline Marxist in New York City and the counterculture Dreamers on a farm in western Massachusetts, which was where Marshall Bloom had killed himself, just 25 years old and now dead from carbon monoxide poisoning. And with that death, Ferguson had begun to lose faith in the closed-off world of far-left journalism, which at times seemed to have gone just as insane as the splinter groups from defunct SDS. And now that the Los Angeles Free Press was publishing a regular column written by Charles Manson, Ferguson wanted no part of that world anymore. He hated the right, he hated the government, but now he hated the false revolution of the far left as well. And if that meant having to work for a middle-of-the-road paper like the Rochester Times Union, then so be it. He had to start somewhere, and McManus had promised to give him a real chance, if and when he proved himself. It was a rough initiation. He was put on the city desk, the youngest of several reporters, working under a man named Joe Dunlap, who correctly or incorrectly saw Ferguson as McManus's fair-haired boy, his hotshot Ivy League protege, the chosen one among the newcomers to the staff. And consequently, Dunlap made a point of being hard on Ferguson, for it was the rare article Ferguson handed into him that was not extensively rewritten. Not just the leads and the slant of the stories, but often the words themselves, often to the detriment of the piece as a whole, Ferguson felt, making his articles worse rather than better, as if Dunlap's editorial axe were an instrument not for pruning but for chopping down trees. McManus had warned him about that during their first talk at the West End, and had instructed him never to complain. Dunlap was a boot camp sergeant out to break his spirit, and as a raw buck private, Ferguson had to do what he was told, keep his mouth shut, and not allow his spirit to be broken, no matter how many times he would be tempted to punch Dunlap in the face.